H.J. Smith, Reel 4.
But did you look forward to these training periods?
Oh, yes, yes. Each year, because in addition, in the quiet periods, there was certain ceremonial going on, like guard mounting and other ceremonial parades. King's birthday, coronation, armistice day, and those sort of ceremonial occasions always necessitated a huge amount of marching up and down and saluting and that sort of business. So that the training period was always welcome. It provided a break from the usual routine.
Joint training exercises with other arms of service?
Every year training ended on a higher echelon. You began first of all with the ordinary section and platoon training, then company training, and so it built up as you went through. You got down to the battalion and then the brigade and then the district. And finally, of course, you had the GOC, that's the top boy, in command of the entire area with thousands of troops manoeuvring, doing all sorts of mock exercises. Yes, it always led up to higher formation training. That was the grand finale of any training season.
Think of the general
quality of the leadership, military leadership in India. Well, could
you? Do you think you could switch off? Well, we can always take it out later. What I mean, for instance, is
I'd better not.
Some people have told me they were sending out the worst old dregs from England and keeping all the best behind.
Well.
For the
That wasn't so. You were talking of leadership, you see, was the question, and that was the thing I would rather like to say off the record without that on. But if not, I would prefer to keep what I think to myself, because clearly it wouldn't go down very well with the higher hierarchy, as it were.
Well, you don't have to mention any names.
No.
Do you think that the perhaps lower quality of many of the officers and very good quality of the NCOs was peculiar to India?
No, that was a general throughout the army as such. It may well have been the same, to a lesser or greater extent in the Navy as well, I don't know. But certainly from the army point of view, the officer, the platoon officer, leaned very, very heavily on the platoon sergeant. Very heavily.
And you think that's because of the way that they were created, perhaps with the officers almost buying their way in and with the NCOs all having to compete to get their ranks? Is that what caused the problem?
No, I would say that the material available from the officer class was, shall we say, less concentrated than that of the other ranks. There were few officers, you see, and the officer establishment of a battalion is something to the order of about 30-35, whereas the manpower strength of a battalion is to the order of 800. So that the numbers available, of course, in ratio, are rather unfairly, shall we say, gathered from the one to the other. And the man in the ranks, he's had to rough it in the main. Mind you, don't get me wrong, don't... At one time, this was very, very true. A man joined the army because he was too idle to work, or he was dodging the police. So don't get me wrong, that isn't so, and hasn't been so, for many, many years. You got your recruits in the army because of the difficulties of finding work in civilian life. And they were all hardened cases. They were all people that were capable of roughing it and making their way, the survival of the fittest, as it were, that got into the army. And the cream of that was siphoned off and became non-commissioned officers and warrant officers. And by the time they got halfway up the promotional ladder, they really knew their stuff. And when war broke out, every regular battalion was creamed off of most of its warrant officers and senior NCOs, who were farmed out and became the nucleus of different training establishments that were formed, different units that were being constituted, and so on and so forth. And they immediately filled the officer vacancies so created the cream of what was the pre-war regular army.
Did you find the problem of NCOs who knew India very well, knew the terrain, knew the men and so on, and officers fresh out from Sandhurst or somewhere who practically never heard of India?
Well, a subaltern never got posted to India, not much under about 12 years regular service. He did come straight from Sandhurst to India. He did with the Indian Army, mind you, but not with the British forces. He went to a home battalion first, and having stayed there for about a year, then he was posted the following troop in season to the battalion abroad. Every regiment, which consisted of two regular battalions and a depot — the depot's function was to train the recruits — the two regular battalions, one of which was always serving in England and the other was always serving abroad, and each fed the other. So that the subaltern, straight from Sandhurst, would have a spell in the home battalion first, and then be posted to India after about a year. He didn't go direct.
Did you have enough experience of dealings with the Indian Army to notice differences between the type of Englishmen who were in the Indian Army and the British Army?
Yes, we had experiences in many ways, particularly from a training point of view, where there was a concentration of a district or a division which comprised of perhaps four or five battalions of various branches of the Indian Army and two or three battalions of the British Army. You intermingled. Their training sessions were exactly the same as your own. You took part in exercises with them and briefings and so on and so forth at a higher level always took place in a mixed ratio. Shall we say, down to company commanders, if the area commander called a conference, a training conference of that. It meant that the company commanders of all the Indian regiments all came in as well. There is this about the Indian Army, though. You see, there was a duplication. Where there was an Indian officer, invariably there was a British officer. So that the establishment of a British battalion would be 30, 35 officers. In an Indian battalion, there would be double that number. There was the King's commissioned officer and the Viceroy's commissioned officer. And the Viceroy's commissioned officer, of course, always was an Indian who was merely being schooled in his job by, shall we say, his shadow. The one shadowed the other. So that the British officers that formed part of the Indian Army, one of their requirements was that they had to speak the language like the natives themselves, so that they thoroughly understood what was going on. There was no question of any misunderstanding because of the language difficulty, you see. So that the Indian Army officer, the Britisher, who formed part of the Indian Army officer clientele, was very, very familiar with the language problems that went on in the Indian Army. And you met these people, together with their Indian counterparts, at these various conferences and get-togethers and so on and so forth, in an area, shall we say, if you could liken it unto places like Delhi or Lucknow, where Armistice Day parades take place. There's a mixture of all troops in the area, all gathered together. They all do the same thing, so that the instructions to all of them are exactly the same, given out by the force commander who happens to be commanding at that time. So one did mix to a very, very large extent from that point of view. And in camp in areas, there would be rows and rows and rows of tents. The Indians, of course, would be in their rows and the British troops in theirs, separated by just a few yards only in between. Their habits and manners, of course, are entirely different. You remember the old school days, you were taught that if the shadow of an infidel passed over the food being prepared by the Indian, he would cast it aside and not eat it, and that sort of thing. Well, those beliefs were still strongly held by the Indians, and as far as it was possible, they were respected for that by the British, who went out of their way to be friendly and not to transgress on any of these tribal customs that were known to exist.
I've been told that the British officers in the Indian Army rather looked down on the British Army and thought they didn't know as much about what they were doing. And there was both a social and a military snobbery on their part.
Yes, that was very, very true. There was that aspect about it. That was more in the way of friendly rivalry rather than anything else. Anything you can do, we can do better, that idea. It's, you'll find that with the housewife in the kitchen, equally the road sweeper with a broom, and so on and so forth. And it was the same principle that existed between the Indians. The Indians were good, of course. They were used to the heat. We weren't, so that they would be able to withstand quite a lot that we were unable to do. On the other hand, of course, the cold nights in places like Quetta didn't affect us very, very much, not in the same way as it did the Indian. The Indian, born and bred on the plains, suddenly finds himself with an Indian unit stationed in a place like Quetta where it's terribly cold. In fact, I've never been colder in my life than in India, in places like Quetta. Well, then we, equally, in places like that, would be at an advantage and he at a disadvantage.
You mentioned mountain warfare. Were you ever involved in jungle warfare, which was another potential in India?
Only during the war, of course, in Burma.
I mean in your training?
No, because there's very little jungle in India, of course. You've got to get out of India and get into Assam, shall we say, before you come across any terrain that's suitable for training in the type of warfare one would get in the jungle. So the answer to that is no. But during the war with the Japanese, of course, it was all jungle warfare.
Now, after you left Quetta, I'd like you to tell me about your troop train going to Bombay.
To begin with, then, there are no corridor trains in India. One does a journey at home here in England, shall we say, no further than King's Cross to Edinburgh, and it takes 6, 8, 10 hours. But frequently journeys in India take 5 or 6 days. And to move a complete battalion of many hundreds of men, of course, is rather a problem. And so that it doesn't disrupt the Indian train service, there are troop trains used simply and solely for the transportation of troops for long journeys. And these, as I say, are non-corridor, the same as all the other trains are non-corridor. And the middle bit of it is made up of a travelling kitchen. And that's staffed. These troop trains are staffed by British personnel. There's a train conducting warrant officer as a rule. He's a warrant officer class one, who is a British person. Of the Indian Army, the Indian Army has quite a lot of Europeans in it, and the troop trains are so organized that for a long journey, shall we say, from Quetta to Bombay, which took, I think, 4 nights and 5 days, or it may have been the other way around, the feeding arrangements for a large number of men produces quite a problem. But it's helped to a very large extent in that between the journeys it passes through many garrison areas where supplies can be taken on from stage to stage. So that it begins its journey, does the troop train, well stocked with tinned foods like bully beef, diced carrots, anything that goes in a tin, like tin milk and so on and so forth, is well stocked in the troop train before it starts. And then, according to the areas through which it passes and the time it takes, arrangements are made to pick up perishable commodities like fresh meat, bread, vegetables, and in some cases fresh milk, but not often. But at any rate, things like fresh meat, vegetables and bread are arranged en route, and the rest of the journey is done by opening hundreds of tins. Well then, that has to tie up. It travels on the normal main lines of the Indian rail system, but it has to tie up in such a way and be so arranged that it doesn't interfere with the ordinary train service. So frequently one is shunted into a siding and you cool your heels in the siding for half an hour or so whilst a train passes, and on you go again. So that perhaps one of the reasons why a train journey takes so long on a troop train. I could add that going across from the country, that is from west to east, say Bombay to Calcutta, a distance of about 2,000 miles by ordinary mail train on the ordinary civilian passenger service, that journey takes the better part of 2 days, and you probably will break into the third day. That goes uninterrupted, a distance of 2,000 miles. So to get back to Quetta then, with these shunting ideas into sidings and so on, have to be arranged so that it doesn't dislocate the normal rail system, and it does tie up with normal feeding times. Give or take half an hour either way. Breakfast normally perhaps be at 8 o'clock. Well, if you pulled into a siding at 7:30 or at 7 o'clock or 8:30, you just had to make do with that, you see. Now, that's how the troops were fed on the train. They would pull into a siding, everybody would get out, and from the kitchen, which is cooking the food during the journey, everybody then is served and so on and so forth. But it's a different thing with the officer class, and to a large extent to the warrant officers and to the members of the sergeant's mess. Members of the sergeant's mess usually arrange their own little show. They have a portion of the kitchen where they can do their own cooking and so on and so forth. But the officers are out on a limb on this. And they therefore make do on a sandwich and thermo basis until they arrive at different mainline stations large enough that have a restaurant service, so that one then telegraphs ahead, the station master will do this for you, shall we say, from A to B. They sort out which is the next biggest place nearest to your breakfast or dinner meal or so on and so forth, and they order 30 or 40 lunches or 20 or 30 dinners at night and so on and so forth, so that when the train pulls into there, the officers merely go to the restaurant and have a meal there. Perhaps it may be of interest, particularly to families, that is, to say something about these restaurants. In the bigger termini, there are restrooms. One can have things on a bed and breakfast basis where one is changing trains and there are long waits. A pretty difficult position with a military family travelling with a couple of infants and so on and so forth. They need to be fed and changed and bathed and so on and so forth. So that in certain of these larger places, it is possible to get a room for the night in the restaurant, in the upper portions of it, with baths laid on and food and so on and so forth downstairs in the restaurant. Very, very convenient indeed. An idea that would be very, very popular, I fear, if it was ever introduced into England. There are one or two things of that kind that backward countries have that we haven't got yet here in England. And we could well do with something like that in the larger terminals. But however, that's how it's done then, these long train journeys, the troop trains themselves aren't terribly comfortable, and everybody travels with a bedding bundle. So you sleep at night where you sit by day. You merely unroll your bedding bundle, and you get your head down and try as far as you're able to sleep. And there are these halts, conveniently arranged as near to feeding times as possible, and it's quite an experience to do one of these train journeys. Ordinarily, if you're moving with a small party, you do it in the ordinary train, on the ordinary train service. But if it's a large party of, shall we say, company strength and above, one of these troop trains are called in. They're used, of course, every year for the trooping season. Troops coming back to England and troops arriving from England being picked up at places like Karachi and Bombay in these troop trains and being trained then all the way up country to the various units to which they're posted, so that during the season, March to September, the trooping season, these troop trains are used to a very great extent. Troop movements, moving from station A to station B within India, are usually arranged outside the trooping season so that it doesn't interfere with the normal transfer of troops from port to station.
You said it wasn't a corridor train. What sort of carriages were there?
They were large carriages, practically the size of this room. Not quite, but I would say that they were 6-7 feet wide. This is the normal train I'm talking about, the normal coaches. It would hold 6 or 8 people with couch arrangements seating during the day, which fold down and become a bed at night. There would be 2 on that side, 2 this side, 4, 6 or 8 people according to the size of it. And you just couldn't communicate one to the other until it stopped at a station, and then one could get out and walk along and so on and so forth. But no corridor trains as we know them as such.
And where were your wife and children?
They usually travelled in the same train, but if there were families travelling, they would switch onto the same... if families were travelling, and they frequently were, they would arrange for a normal passenger coach to be switched on the end of the troop train so that they travelled in a great deal more comfort than the troops themselves. And they usually travelled family to family. Husbands travelled with the troops. And in a coach of this size, holding six, families were allotted particular coaches according to the number of children they had and the seating capacity of the coach, allowing for sleeping arrangements, of course, at night. All families carried a bedding bundle, and you merely sat on these seats during the day, and at night time undid your bedding bundle and slept and rolled your bedding bundle up the following day, and so on.
Where was the family luggage?
Where would the...
The family's luggage.
Oh, that always went with the battalion baggage. You had things like wanted on voyage, as it were, wanted on journey, handbags and picnic baskets and so on and so forth. They went with the, providing they weren't too bulky, of course, they went with the family in the coach in which they were travelling. Mothers with infants particularly had to have tins of Glaxo and all sorts of other things necessary for the journey. And if it was at all possible, fresh milk would be arranged for those families at the larger stations. There's a military dairy farm system operates in India for the supply of fresh milk. You cannot rely on the milk produced by the goat herd in the village. It has to be done under military arrangement in order to ensure that it really is pure. So there's the military farms organization exists in India, and on these long journeys it would be arranged that the nearest one would be present at the station with a couple of churns of fresh milk at the time that this train was expected in.